What if I told you that things like chronic fatigue, persistent anxiety, and even severe depression aren't actually signs that your body is broken?
Right.
Like, what if instead of being these random glitches in your biological machinery, these conditions are actually proof that your body is desperately and quite successfully, by the way, trying to keep you alive?
It is, it's a complete inversion of how we normally think about being sick. We are just so conditioned to view symptoms as mechanical failures.
Exactly. I
Yeah.
mean, we want the body to work like a car.
Yeah.
You know, the check engine light comes on, you take it to the mechanic, they plug in that little diagnostic computer, find the one bad sensor, they replace it, and you just drive off. It's incredibly satisfying. And for a long time, we've basically tried to force human biology into that exact same mold.
We have. And yeah, to be fair to the medical establishment, in some areas, that model has been spectacularly successful.
Oh, sure.
Like if you step on a rusty nail and get a severe bacterial infection,
Yeah.
you absolutely want a doctor who is going to act like a mechanic.
Give me the antibiotics, yeah.
Yeah, right. You want an antibiotic that targets that specific bacteria. That is medical reductionism at its finest.
Yep.
You isolate a single cause and you deliver a single targeted intervention.
But then, you look at the landscape of modern health today. You look at autoimmune conditions, chronic pain, metabolic syndromes, or mental health struggles that just seem to cascade across different bodily systems.
They don't stay in one lane.
Right, they completely ignore those neat little diagnostic boxes, and suddenly that mechanic's toolbox isn't just useless, it's actually kind of blinding us to what's really going on.
That is the exact tension at the heart of the research we're unpacking today.
Yes, so welcome in, everyone. We are taking a deep dive today into a sweeping, truly paradigm-shifting white paper by Dr. Bachara Sareli. It was published on May 3, 2026, and it's titled Mitochondria, Structural Coupling, and Intrinsic Health.
Toward a non-reductionist psychobiology of living.
That's the one. And it is a massive conceptual leap.
It really is.
Yeah.
The paper doesn't just offer like a new treatment protocol or a new drug. It actually proposes an entirely new language of living.
And our mission for this deep dive is to deconstruct that new language. We're going to look at the cutting-edge intersection of two massive ideas that Saheeli brings together. On one side, we have mitochondrial psychobiology.
Which is rooted in the incredible work of Martin Picard.
Yes, exactly. And then on the other side, we have the biology of living, which is a biological and philosophical framework pioneered by Humberto Maturana.
So if you are listening to this right now and you've ever felt incredibly frustrated because the medical system treats your body as just a collection of isolated parts,
Right, your stomach in one department, your brain in another.
right? Your immune system in a third while completely ignoring the context of your life, your stress, your sleep, or your relationships.
Yeah.
Well, this deep dive is going to validate exactly what you've been experiencing.
Oh, absolutely. Because the ultimate revelation of this paper is how your lived experience literally becomes your biology. Dr. Saley introduces this entire framework as a blueprint to fix what he calls the fragmentation of modern health science.
We've separated the mind from the body.
Yes, the body from the surrounding world and the tiny cell from the whole organism.
And that fragmentation is precisely why we struggle so much with chronic conditions. When you only look at the isolated parts, human health cannot be adequately understood.
Right.
You end up with a medical system that acknowledges, okay, sure, chronic stress is bad for your body, but it lacks a coherent molecular theory of how the microscopic energy of your cells and the macroscopic organization of your whole life actually interact.
It's like we just sort of wave our hands and say, well, stress causes inflammation without actually explaining the bridge between a bad day at work and a biological shift in your tissue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We just assume there's a connection. And that's why this paper brings together these two titans. Artim Picard's work provides the energetic and cellular depth. He shows us what's happening at the absolute core of our cells.
Down at the very bottom.
Right. Meanwhile, Humberto Maturana provides the relational and organizational depth, explaining how the entire organism operates as a unified whole in its environment.
But to even begin to understand how those two worlds connect, we have to start by unlearning one of the biggest cliches in high school biology.
Oh boy.
We have to completely redefine the mitochondria. And honestly, I feel like I owe my high school biology teacher an apology.
Because of the powerhouse thing,
Yes,
right?
the phrase "the powerhouse of the cell" is practically burned into my brain.
It is burned into everyone's brain. And look, the powerhouse metaphor isn't entirely wrong. Mitochondria do produce ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the foundational currency of cellular energy. But Picard's work over the last decade has revealed that reducing the mitochondria to just a cellular battery is not just incomplete, it drastically limits our understanding of human health.
I was actually trying to come up with an analogy for this while I was reading the paper. Calling a mitochondrion just a powerhouse feels like calling a modern smartphone just a flashlight.
Well, that's good.
Like, sure, a smartphone has a light on it. It serves that function perfectly well. But to define the entire device by that one function ignores the fact that it's actually a massive communication device.
Right.
It's constantly receiving signals, processing data, and connecting to a global network.
I think we can actually take that smartphone analogy even further. Because the smartphone doesn't just receive data passively, it changes its own internal state based on what it receives.
Oh, like dimming the screen when the battery is low.
Exactly, or shutting down apps when it overheats.
Yeah.
According to Picard's mitochondrial psychobiology, mitochondria have a vast biological resume that operates on very similar principles.
So they're reacting.
Yes, they are highly dynamic organelles. They literally change their physical shape in real time.
Wait, really?
Oh, yeah. They fuse together into massive networks when they need to share resources. They divide and split apart when they're damaged, and they physically move around the cell to where energy is needed most.
Okay, let's actually unpack some of the items on that biological resume, because the paper lists several functions, and I want to make sure we understand how they're doing these things, not just what they're doing.
Sure.
So the text mentions they participate in calcium handling. Normally, when I hear calcium, I just think of, you know, drinking a glass of milk for strong bones. Yeah. What does calcium handling mean inside a single cell?
That's a vital distinction. Inside a cell, calcium isn't about structural support at all. It is a highly reactive signaling ion.
Okay.
Think of a sudden rush of free calcium inside a cell, like a blaring fire alarm.
Yeah.
If calcium levels get too high, the cell can become incredibly toxic and actually destroy itself. So mitochondria act like a sponge, or a buffer system, for this alarm. They actively pull calcium out of the intracellular fluid to quiet the alarm. Or, if a massive immune response is genuinely needed, they can release calcium to amplify the signal.
Wow. Okay, so they are actively managing the cell's panic responses.
Yes.
The text also mentions steroidogenesis. I know that relates to steroids or hormones, but are mitochondria actually making our hormones?
They are initiating the process, the very first rate-limiting step of producing crucial hormones like cortisol, our primary stress hormone, or sex hormones like testosterone and estrogen, happens literally inside the mitochondria.
Inside it.
Right. Cholesterol has to be transported into the mitochondria to be converted into the precursor for all these hormones. So your body's ability to mount a hormonal response to a stressful event is fundamentally dependent on mitochondrial function.
And then there's the one that completely blew my mind, apoptosis. The paper describes this as programmed cell death. Are you telling me that these tiny little organelles are deciding whether the cell they live inside gets to survive or die?
They are intimately involved in that final judgment, yes. If a cell is damaged beyond repair, perhaps by a virus or massive oxidative damage, it's dangerous for that cell to just rupture and spill its toxic contents everywhere.
Because that causes inflammation.
Massive inflammation, known as necrosis. Apoptosis is a clean, organized dismantling of the cell from the inside. And it's the mitochondria that release specific proteins, like cytochrome C, which act as the executioners.
The executioners.
Yeah, they trigger this clean self-destruct sequence.
That is fascinating. So they are batteries, they are the fire alarm managers, they are the hormone initiators, and they are the executioners.
A pretty extensive resume.
Seriously. What Picard is doing here is extending this microscopic view into the domain of human experience. He is showing that mitochondria are the translation mechanism. They are taking psychological states, stress, trauma, and social conditions, and translating them into biological states.
Let's look at exactly how that translation happened, because the paper brings up a concept that sounds almost like a sci-fi movie. Cell-free mitochondrial DNA.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I had to reread that paragraph 3 times because I'm picturing these stressed out little organelles literally ejecting their own DNA out of the cell entirely. Is that really what is happening?
It is exactly what is happening. To understand why this is so profound, you have to remember that mitochondria have their own unique DNA.
Right.
Completely separate from the DNA in the nucleus of your cells. When a person experiences severe acute psychological stress or massive physical trauma, the mitochondria become so overburdened that they fragment. and pieces of their DNA are expelled not just out of the mitochondria, but out of the cell entirely into the bloodstream.
So they're basically shooting off flare guns into the blood.
Yes.
But how does the rest of the body interpret that flare?
This is where evolutionary history comes into play. Because mitochondrial DNA is circular and resembles bacterial DNA, which we'll definitely come back to later, the body's immune system recognizes this circulating mitochondrial DNA as a foreign invader.
It thinks it's an infection.
It thinks there is a massive infection.
Oh my God. So the immune system sees the mitochondrial DNA, assumes it's a bacterial attack, and triggers a massive systemic inflammatory response.
Precisely. Even if there is no actual pathogen present, the emotional or psychological stress literally becomes systemic biological inflammation through the behavior of the mitochondria.
That is wild.
Sleep disruption, social isolation, chronic adversity. The paper details how all of these experiences alter the diversity of the mitochondrial network, change their shape, and compromise their energy efficiency.
Okay, I'm tracking all this, but I have to pause and push back on something here. If mitochondria are managing the fire alarms, initiating our stress hormones, deciding if cells live or die, and triggering systemic inflammation by throwing their DNA into the bloodstream, I mean, it sounds like they are the secret bosses running the human body.
Right.
Are we just giant meat suits being puppeteered by microscopic executives pulling all the levers?
I completely understand why you'd ask that. It's a very seductive idea, especially when we look at how powerful they are. But Sahili's paper is incredibly careful to warn against this exact conclusion.
Okay.
Mitochondria are not hidden master controllers. They do not explain the phenomenon of living strictly from below.
If they aren't the dictators, what are they?
The paper uses a very specific phrase. They are energetic relational participants.
Energetic relational participants.
Yeah. Think about it this way. A steering wheel doesn't drive a car, and an engine doesn't decide the destination. They participate in the act of driving.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mitochondria participate in the organism's ongoing regulation rather than directing it from some microscopic boardroom.
Yeah.
They are embedded in the living dynamics of the organism. They are shaped by the cell's environment just as much as they shape that environment.
I see. So the smartphone analogy kind of holds up. The phone processes the network signals, but the phone doesn't invent the internet. It participates in it.
Exactly.
But if the mitochondria are just participating, how does the body as a whole actually decide how to respond? Like, who or what is calling the shots?
To answer that, we have to look away from the microscopic cell. We have to zoom all the way out to the entire organism. We need to ask, how does a living thing actually make decisions and adapt to its world?
Right.
And that requires us to step away from Picard's biology for a moment and step into Umberto Maturana's grammar of living.
I love that phrase, the grammar of living. This is where the paper shifts gears into something that feels, honestly, like the philosophy of biology. Maturana approaches living systems from a completely different direction. He isn't looking at parts. He is asking a massive fundamental question. How does a living system conserve itself as a living system?
And to answer that, Maturana introduces three core concepts that we really need to unpack: autopoiesis, structural determinism, and structural coupling.
Okay.
Let's take them one by one because they completely dismantle how we normally view the body.
Let's start with autopoiesis. The text defines this as a self-producing molecular network. I know auto means self, and poiesis means creation or production, like the word poetry.
Yes, self-creation. The profound idea here is that a living system isn't defined just by what it does externally or how it moves. It is defined by the fact that it's constantly recursively producing the very components that make it up.
Producing itself.
Its primary goal, every second of every day, is to conserve its own organization from within.
To keep being itself.
Exactly. A rock doesn't do this. A highly advanced AI computer doesn't do this. A machine is put together by an outside force. Only living things constantly recreate their own boundaries and their own internal networks.
Okay, so we are self-producing systems. That brings us to the second concept, which the paper calls structural determinism. And honestly, this one is a bit of a brain bender.
It is.
The text says, and I quote, "An organism changes according to its own structure. The outside world can perturb it, but it cannot instruct it."
This is arguably Maturana's most profound challenge to our conventional thinking. We usually view the human body as an input-output machine.
Right.
You experience a stressor, that's the input. Your body produces cortisol, that's the output. It implies that the environment is directly programming your response.
That's wrong.
Maturana says unequivocally, no. That is not how living systems work.
Let me try to build an analogy here to see if I'm really grasping this, because the difference between perturbing and instructing feels incredibly important.
Go for it.
So if the environment doesn't program us, it's like the difference between pressing a button on a vending machine versus asking a friend for a favor.
Okay, let's explore that.
With the vending machine, you press button A and it outputs soda A. The input directly instructs the output. It's a mechanical guarantee.
Right.
But a human being isn't a vending machine. If you asked a friend for a favor, the way they respond is not guaranteed by your request. They might say yes enthusiastically. They might snap at you. They might ignore you completely.
Yeah.
Their response is determined by their mood, how much sleep they got last night, their history with you, their own internal state.
That is an excellent starting point. The world you request is just perturbing them. It's knocking on the door. But their biology, their structure, decides how to answer. But to make this perfectly accurate to Maturana's theory, we have to upgrade your analogy slightly.
Okay, upgrade it how?
Imagine if that friend's physical brain, their literal biological structure, was actually permanently altered by every single favor you had ever asked them in the past.
Oh, wow. So it's not just a passing mood. It's a structural reality built over time.
Exactly. That is structural determinism. Their structure holds the history of every previous interaction. This completely destroys the input-output machine view of the human body.
It does.
And it explains a phenomenon that doctors and therapists see every single day. Why two different people can experience the exact same event, a stressful meeting with a boss, a specific viral infection, or a new diet, and have radically, entirely different biological outcomes.
Because their internal structures are entirely different.
Yes.
One person's structure has a history of secure attachment, plenty of sleep, and prior successful immune recoveries. Another person's structure is built on a history of childhood trauma, chronic inflammation, and sleep deprivation.
Precisely. The event is the same perturbation, but the structures answering the door are different. What's so empowering about this is that it protects us from viewing human beings as passive victims of their environment, just waiting to be programmed by inputs.
It gives them agency.
It gives the organism agency, and it honors the organism's history.
It totally redefines the word stress. The paper explicitly states that stress is no longer an external input. We can't say, my job is the stress.
Right.
The job is just a perturbation. Stress is actually the internal response of a structure-determined living system trying to handle that perturbation.
Which leads us perfectly to the third concept, structural coupling. Because obviously we aren't just isolated, self-producing structures floating in a dark void. We live in an environment. We live in a medium.
The paper defines structural coupling as the recurrent history of congruent change between the living system and its environment. They mutually adapt.
It's a continuous dance. You are not a sealed object. As you move through your environment, you change it. And as the environment changes, it perturbs you. And your structure changes to adapt.
It goes both ways.
It is a recurrent history of mutual change. Your ongoing viability, your health, your very life depends entirely on conserving this relationship, this coupling with the medium.
Okay, I want to pause and look at the massive architecture we've just built in our minds here.
Let's do it.
On one side, we have Martin Picard's communicative, participating, shape-shifting mitochondria, deeply sensing the cellular world. And on the other side, we have Humberto Maturana's self-producing, historically shaped organism, constantly dancing and coupling with its macroscopic environment.
Right.
What happens when Dr. Sanchuli crashes these two distinct theories into each other?
When you bring them together, you get what the paper calls organelle niche coupling. This is the exact meeting point of microscopic energy and macroscopic relation.
The text makes it very clear that mitochondria do not exist in a vacuum. Just like the organism lives in an environment, the mitochondria live in an environment. It's called an intricate intracellular niche.
Yes.
What exactly is floating around in this microscopic neighborhood?
The text lists a whole host of components, and every single one is crucial for cellular health. This niche includes the local oxygen tension, the substrate supply, which is essentially the amount and type of fuel available, like glucose or fatty acid. The immediate demand for ATP, the flux of calcium ions we talked about earlier, ROS, or reactive oxygen species signaling.
We'll definitely get to ROS later.
Right. And it includes the physical architecture of the mitochondrial folds called cristae, what the cell's nucleus is currently transcribing, and the overall inflammatory tone of the surrounding fluid.
That is a wildly crowded and busy neighborhood.
It is incredibly dynamic. And the breakthrough insight here is that the mitochondria and this intracellular niche co-specify one another. It's structural coupling all over again. just at a microscopic scale.
Wow.
The niche shapes how the organelle behaves, whether it produces energy efficiently or throws out a flare gun of DNA, and the organelle's behavior continuously reshapes the niche. It's a deeply recursive relationship.
I want to share a visual from the paper that gave me a massive aha moment. It's a diagram of nested circles showing how we can zoom all the way out to the whole world and then cascade all the way back into the tiny organelle.
Let's walk through it because it perfectly illustrates the synthesis of these two theories.
So imagine a set of Russian nesting dolls. The outermost largest doll is the ecological medium, the broad physical environment, the air quality, the societal structure.
Okay.
Tucked inside that is the social relation doll, your friends, your family, your workplace dynamics. Inside that is the organism doll, your whole body. Mm. Then the tissue, then the cell, and finally the tiny innermost doll is the mitochondrion.
That's a great visual, but to make it accurate to Saheeli's paper, we have to add a dynamic element to it.
Right, because they aren't just sitting statically inside one another. It's more like these Russian nesting dolls are all connected by a single, tightly pulled, vibrating string. If you pluck the string from the outside, that vibration travels through every single layer.
Let's trace a real-world scenario from the text to see how that vibration actually travels.
Mm.
Let's say you experience a severe perturbation at the level of the social relation doll. Maybe you suddenly lose your job, or you are living in a fundamentally unsafe, hostile environment.
Okay, so the string is plucked.
That social threat perturbs the organism. Your brain perceives the threat, which shifts your entire neuroendocrine system. Your body physically prepares for danger.
Fight or flight.
Right. This systemic shift alters the chemical environment of your individual tissues. The change in the tissue alters the inflammatory tone and oxygen tension inside the specific cellular niche.
Mm.
And that localized change specifically alters the gene expression, the shape, and the energy production of that tiny inner doll, the mitochondrion.
The social threat literally travels down the string and changes how the mitochondrial engine runs.
Exactly. But it doesn't stop there, because the string vibrates in both directions.
That goes back out.
Yes. Those newly altered mitochondria change the way they signal to the rest of the cell. That alters the tissue function. The tissue function changes how the whole organism feels, perhaps creating a deep sense of physical fatigue or brain fog. And that fatigue changes how you behave in your social relations. You might withdraw from your friends, which creates a new social reality, which plucks the string all over again. It is a continuous, unbroken loop of coupling.
It is absolutely mesmerizing to view human life that way. It makes so much sense. But the text also includes a very stark warning right after this section. Dr. Saheel warns researchers and doctors against what he calls an interpretive collapse. What is he afraid we are going to do with this nesting doll model?
He is warning us against losing the balance between these different scales of reality.
Eh.
Because human beings love simple answers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tendency to collapse the complexity. He warns against two specific traps. The first is reductionism from below.
That's the master controller trap we talked about earlier, right?
Yes. That's looking at the entire complexity of human suffering, depression, poverty, trauma, and saying, well, you are just your cellular batteries. If we just fix the mitochondria with a magic pill, everything will be fine. That abstracts the mitochondria away from the social reality.
Okay, and what is the second trap?
The second trap is dualism from above. That's treating the mind, the emotions, or the social environment as if they magically affect health without actual physical, energetic processes happening in the cells.
Like toxic positivity.
Exactly. It's saying just think positive thoughts and you'll heal, while ignoring the massive energetic and redox constraints at the cellular level. We have to hold the dialogue without collapsing it. We need the molecular specificity and the organismic relation.
We need to acknowledge both the social string being plucked and the specific physical vibration it causes in the cell, which means we need to look at the exact molecular language that vibration is using.
And according to the paper, that language is redox.
Right. Which brings us to a massive reality check. We need to move way, way past the 1990s antioxidant hype for this one.
We really do. For decades, the common medical language, and certainly the language of the multi-billion-dollar supplement industry, has been built on a very simple, very flawed premise. The premise is that oxidative stress is simply a battle between bad guys and good guys.
Right. You have free radicals, these dangerous, unstable molecules roaming around causing damage and aging you. So you need to consume massive amounts of antioxidants to neutralize them.
Yep.
And I will admit, I feel personally attacked by this section of the paper. I literally put a massive handful of blueberries and a vitamin C packet in my smoothie every single morning for exactly that reason.
And blueberries are delicious and wonderful for you.
Thank you.
But the model driving that behavior is radically incomplete.
Yeah.
The text argues that redox balance is not a war between oxidants and antioxidants. It is the dynamic organization of electron flow, oxygen use, ROS signaling, and repair capacity.
Okay, we need to break this down carefully. The paper distinguishes between oxidative stress and reductive stress. And I'll be honest, reductive stress was an entirely new concept for me. I had never even heard of it.
Most people haven't, but it is critical to understanding chronic illness. Oxidative stress is the rust we are familiar with. It occurs when you have excess reactive oxygen species, ROS, that exceed the system's capacity to buffer and repair. Electrons leak out of the mitochondrial engine, they damage proteins and DNA, and cellular damage happens.
That's the classic bad guy scenario. So what is reductive stress?
Reductive stress is the exact opposite problem. This happens when there is excessive reducing pressure in the system.
I need you to explain what reducing pressure means at the molecular level.
Let's use an analogy. In cellular biology, molecules like NADH and NADPH act like tiny delivery trucks.
Delivery trucks, okay.
Their job is to carry high energy electrons, which we can think of as cargo, to the mitochondria so that energy can be produced. In a healthy state, the trucks deliver the cargo, the mitochondria process it, and the trucks go back empty to get more.
That was efficient.
But reductive stress means you have way too many loaded delivery trucks. You have excess NADH and NADPH relative to the system's capacity to actually use them and transform that electron cargo into organized biological work.
So there's a bottleneck.
You have massive potential energy and nowhere for it to go.
The text actually calls this electron congestion, which is such a vivid phrase. So to bring this back to my morning routine, what does this mean for the trend of just swallowing huge doses of antioxidants? Antioxidants are essentially molecules that donate electrons, right?
Exactly. Antioxidants are electron donors. They are more delivery trucks.
So if someone is already in a state of reductive stress, meaning they have electron congestion, taking massive doses of antioxidants is like trying to fix a massive traffic jam by pouring thousands of extra cars onto the highway.
That is precisely what you are doing.
The issue isn't a lack of cars. The issue is that the traffic isn't flowing. You're just adding more pressure to a system that is already completely gridlocked. And the text points out a really cruel paradox here.
The leakage.
Yeah. Having too many electron donors, this reductive stress, creates a back pressure in the mitochondria that actually causes oxidative injury. Because the system is so jammed, electrons are forced to leak out the sides.
Yes. The electron leakage from the traffic jam generates the very free radicals, the ROS, that you were originally trying to prevent by taking the antioxidants. The deeper issue here isn't oxidant excess. It is a loss of what Dr. Stanley calls redox congruence.
Redox congruence. So redox stress isn't just a measure of how much molecular damage is happening. It's a measure of the loss of congruence in how the whole system is organized. The traffic is disorganized.
Exactly. And this is where Maturana's concept of structural coupling comes rushing back in. Because what causes the traffic jam? Redox balance is a molecular register of coupling. It is how your relationship with the macro environment is physically recorded in your microcells.
So when I'm sleep deprived, eating highly processed food, and dealing with a massive social threat at work, my body's ability to process energy smoothly breaks down. My electron traffic literally backs up.
Yes. Your environmental perturbations have exceeded your structure's ability to maintain organized flow. Your redox congruence is lost.
But why does this traffic jam happen in the first place? Why can't the body just indefinitely handle the stress and keep the traffic flowing? To answer that, we have to look at how our bodies handle the actual literal cost of staying alive, which brings us to the energy resistance principle.
This concept, developed by Picard and Murugan, challenges another really common assumption we have about biology. We tend to assume that biological efficiency is always best and that any kind of resistance is inherently bad. We want our biology to be frictionless.
Right. Frictionless metabolism sounds like a biohacker's dream.
But biological systems actually require resistance to energy flow in order to transform that energy into useful, organized work. If there is zero resistance in a system, energy just dissipates entirely as heat. It's lost to the universe. You need a certain amount of resistance to create ATP, to send cellular signals, to actually drive complex behavior.
The analogy I came up with for this is riding a bicycle. You need some resistance, you need the friction of the tires against the pavement, you need the physical tension in the chain to actually convert the energy of your legs into forward movement.
It's exactly.
If you suspend a bicycle in midair, so there is zero resistance, you can pedal as fast as you want, but you aren't going anywhere. You're just spinning.
I love that. Energy resistance is not inherently pathological. It's the very mechanism of how energy becomes biologically useful.
However.
There's always a however in biology.
Right, however, excessive resistance becomes incredibly costly. If the resistance in the system is too high, the energy transformation process becomes incredibly inefficient. It produces excessive heat, systemic inflammation, molecular damage, and a massive loss of biological information.
Wow.
The organism keeps functioning, it stays alive, but it is paying a massive, punishing energetic tax to do so.
To stick with the bicycle analogy, it's like riding your bike with the brakes clamped hard against the wheel.
Right.
You can still pedal, you can still force the bike to move forward, but you're exhausting yourself just to maintain a normal walking speed.
Mm-hmm.
You are technically surviving, you are making forward progress, but the cost is brutal. And this perfectly sets up Maturana's ultimate definition of what living actually is. He defines living as conservation under constraint. The organism must conserve its organization. It must stay alive, whatever the energetic cost.
This makes me think about the difference between an adaptive challenge and a chronic burden, because obviously going to the gym is adding resistance, but it's good for us. The text distinguishes very carefully between the two.
Yes, the distinction is vital. An adaptive challenge like intense exercise, learning a difficult new language, fasting intervals, or even doing the hard emotional work of relational repair. These all temporarily increase energetic demand.
You are pedaling uphill.
Exactly. But doing so actually expands your organismic capacity. Your body responds by building more muscle, creating more resilient neural pathways, or literally synthesizing more mitochondria.
But a chronic burden.
A chronic burden is completely different. Chronic sleep disruption, persistent isolation and loneliness, metabolic overload from an ultra-processed diet, or living in an unsafe, traumatic environment. These increase the energetic demand in ways that narrow your capacity.
Right.
You are constantly fighting excessive energy resistance. You are surviving, but your adaptive flexibility is shrinking day by day.
The paper redefines the word stress yet again through this specific energetic lens. Stress is the energetic cost of conserving your life under strained relations. It's the literal cost of pedaling with the brakes on.
And when that energetic cost remains too high for too long, it completely changes how we understand chronic disease and profoundly how we understand mental health.
Which brings us to what I found to be the most profound, deeply moving part of this entire paper, the section on emotioning, intrinsic health, and costly conserved drift. This section fundamentally changed how I view chronic illness. It's incredibly compassionate.
It is a deeply compassionate framework, but it is grounded entirely in hard molecular science. It starts by taking Maturana's concept of emotioning and applying it to health. Maturana argues that emotions aren't just private internal feelings floating ethereally in your mind.
Okay.
They are bodily dispositions that specify domains of action.
I need a concrete example of this. How does a bodily disposition specify an action?
Think about the physical difference between fear and curiosity. Fear isn't just a psychological feeling. It physically configures your entire biology.
Spikes your heart rate.
Right. It alters your muscle tension, shunts blood away from your digestion, and alters your metabolic allocation to prepare you to either fight, flee, or freeze. That physical configuration literally closes down certain worlds of relation. You are not going to playfully explore a new hobby or peacefully digest a heavy meal when your body is structurally locked into a state of fear.
That makes total sense.
Curiosity, on the other hand, physically opens you up. Your parasympathetic nervous system engages, your field of vision broadens, your digestion works smoothly. It makes different domains of action possible.
So emotioning is about what actions your body is physically and energetically prepared to take based on its ongoing relationship with the environment.
Exactly. And the mitochondria, while they don't cause these emotional worlds, they deeply participate in the energetic and redox conditions that make certain domains of action more or less available to you.
Let's apply this to how the paper reframes specific clinical conditions, because this is where the theory hits reality. Let's start with fatigue.
Okay.
The conventional framing is just low energy. A doctor might say, well, fatigue is a symptom of your illness.
But the Maturana-Picard framing sees fatigue entirely differently. Fatigue is defined as narrowed organismic possibility under energetic load. Your body isn't just out of gas in a simple mechanical sense.
It's doing it on purpose.
It is actively, purposefully narrowing what you are capable of doing because the energetic cost of living in your current state is too dangerously high. It is forcing you to shut down to conserve energy.
What about anxiety? Usually we think of anxiety purely as a mental health issue, an excessive worry loop in the brain.
Here, anxiety is redefined as a persistent readiness for threat under altered coupling. Your body is maintaining a highly costly, highly demanding state of vigilance because, historically or currently, your environment has demanded it for survival.
Yeah.
Your structure was determined by a history where letting your guard down was dangerous.
And depression, this is a huge one.
Depression is described not as a chemical imbalance, but as a systemic collapse or narrowing of viable action domains. It's a state where cellular energy, psychological meaning, physical movement, sleep architecture, inflammation, and hope all become deeply dysregulated together.
Wow.
It's a profound restriction of the living system's possible worlds, often as a last-ditch effort to conserve a system that is overwhelmed by cost.
This leads directly to the concept of costly conserve drift, and this was my biggest takeaway from the entire document. The paper argues that chronic disease is not a broken machine. It is not a glitch. It is not a simple defect.
No.
Chronic disease is the organism actively conserving its life under conditions that make healthier, more expansive patterns impossible.
If we really sit with that and connect it to the bigger picture, it removes the blame from the patient's so-called broken body. Your body isn't failing you. The organism may conserve severe vigilance. It may conserve chronic inflammation or metabolic rigidity because those deeply costly patterns are exactly what allows survival under the current constraints.
I literally had to put the paper down and just think about this for 10 minutes. So if I have chronic inflammation, it isn't my immune system failing to work properly. It's my immune system working exactly as it should to survive a terrible environment, whether that environment is a toxic diet, extreme emotional stress, or chronic lack of sleep.
Yes.
It's like a business burning through its savings to stay open during a massive multi-year economic recession. It's not a glitch in the business model. It's a desperate, highly calculated survival strategy.
That is an incredibly accurate analogy. The business is successfully staying open. It is successfully conserving its organization, just as Maturana says a living system must do. But the trajectory of that drift is incredibly costly. Eventually, the savings run out, the debt becomes too high, and the system fails.
This is where the paper makes a crucial distinction between intrinsic health and realized health. Intrinsic health is your internal biological capacity for conserved viability, your savings account, your biological reserves.
Right.
But you can have incredibly high intrinsic health, a ton of biological reserve, and still live in a medium, say, surrounded by environmental toxins, working an abusive job, experiencing profound grief that constantly consumes those reserves.
Right. Your realized health in that harsh medium will be very poor, even if your intrinsic health was strong to begin with. You are surviving, but at a massive, unsustainable cost.
So, if disease is just a costly way of surviving a bad environment, a costly conserved drift, then how do we actually fix it? Because if this is true, we can't just hand out a pill to force the body to stop surviving, right? If you force the struggling business to stop spending its savings without fixing the economy, the business just dies. We have to change the medium. We have to change the conditions.
Which brings us to the final major paradigm shift of Dr. Saley's paper. We have to completely redefine what clinical practice looks like. We need a new paradigm for healing.
The text is very clear. Healing cannot be reduced to the mechanical repair of isolated parts. It redefines healing as recoupling the restoration of conditions under which living can conserve itself with less defensive cost and greater adaptive freedom.
And we should be very clear, this doesn't mean we throw away modern medicine. Drugs, surgery, targeted therapies, they still matter immensely. If you have a ruptured appendix, you need a surgeon, not a theory about your environment. But for chronic conditions, the meaning of these interventions changes. They are no longer viewed as mechanical fixes for a broken machine. They are viewed as tools to help change the internal conditions so the organism can reorganize itself more freely.
The paper translates what we usually call lifestyle factors, which honestly always sounds a bit trivial to me, like a doctor just waving a finger and saying, eat your veggies and go for a walk, into what Saley calls niche conditions for conserved living.
Yeah, that phrasing gives it the weight it deserves.
I want to walk through the text's specific practical domains because the reframing elevates these basic things into profound biological imperatives. Let's start with sleep. It's no longer just rest.
Sleep is reframed as circadian and energetic recoupling. It's not just turning off the machine. It is a highly active state where the system synchronizes its biological clocks and repairs the massive energetic and redox toll accumulated during the day.
Movement. It's not just about burning calories on a treadmill.
Movement is adaptive energetic perturbation. You are intentionally, purposefully perturbing the system to signal the mitochondria to renew their networks, clear out damaged organelles, and build a greater energetic capacity.
Nutrition. It's not just counting macros.
Nutrition is substrate flow and redox support. You are providing the exact physical materials necessary for that complex electron traffic to flow smoothly without causing massive oxidative leakage.
Relational safety.
This is perhaps the most profound one in the context of our society. Relational safety is defined as the reduction of defensive energetic burden. When you feel truly safe with others, your body doesn't have to spend massive amounts of its finite cellular energy maintaining constant vigilance, elevated heart rates, and systemic inflammatory readiness. Safety literally frees up cellular energy for repair.
And finally, psychotherapy. It's not just talking about your feelings.
It is the reorganization of emotioning and action domains. Through language and relational coupling with a therapist, you're literally reshaping how your body physically orientates toward the possibilities of the world. You're changing your structural determinism.
This entire framework completely transforms the role of the doctor. It turns the doctor from a mechanic into a gardener or oncologist.
Right? I'd actually tweak that analogy slightly to make it even more precise. A mechanic replaces a spark plug and walks away. An ecologist looks at a struggling plant, but they don't just paint the yellowing leaves green to make it look healthy.
Right.
They analyze the soil composition, the angle of the sunlight, the water drainage, the surrounding competing root systems to figure out why the plant is defending itself so aggressively and stunting its own growth. They seek to restore viable coupling.
That is a brilliant way to look at it. As the paper's final thesis states, health is living coherence conserved energetically. Mitochondria are among its deepest molecular participants. It's about systemic coherence, not just the absence of a diagnostic defect.
It shifts the entire goal of medicine from fixing the broken part to cultivating the conditions for coherent living.
It changes everything about how you view your own body and your own history. Which brings us to our outro. We've covered a massive amount of ground today, from quantum electron flows to macroscopic social dynamics. But I want to leave everyone with a final provocative thought, something pulled straight from Appendix E of Dr. Cecilie's source material. It's a concept called endosymbiotic relevance.
This is the deep evolutionary history that underpins everything we've talked about today. It's the ultimate why behind the biology.
Right, because billions of years ago, the mitochondrion wasn't just an organelle inside our cells. It was an entirely independent, free-living, oxygen-breathing bacteria.
Amazing to think about.
Over deep evolutionary history, it was engulfed by another larger cell. But instead of the larger cell digesting it, or the smaller cell destroying the host, they formed an incredible partnership. The bacteria provided massive amounts of energy, and the host cell provided a safe, nutrient-rich environment. It became integrated into a completely new composite cellular way of living.
They structurally coupled, the most profound structural coupling in the history of the planet.
They coupled. Our very cells, the fundamental building blocks of our bodies, are literally built on a foundation of independent entities learning to compromise, communicate, and couple together to create a higher, more complex form of life. If the absolute core engine of our biology is, at its root, a story of relational integration and mutual survival, perhaps it's no wonder that our own health today depends entirely on how well we couple with our social, ecological, and psychological worlds.
That is the perfect synthesis. We're a living history of relationships, all the way down to our microscopic core. You are not a machine. You are a continuously adapting, self-producing relationship.
So, to circle back to where we started, the next time your check engine light comes on, whether it manifests as unexplained fatigue, a flare-up of pain, persistent anxiety, or a chronic illness, try not to look for the single broken sensor. Look at the whole landscape. Look at your history, your environment, your emotional safety, your energetic cost. Look at the living unity. Thank you for taking this deep dive into these incredibly profound sources with us. We encourage you to look at your own stress, your sleep, and your connections, not just as items on a health checklist, but as vital, dynamic conversations happening right now at the energetic core of your being. Keep exploring, keep learning, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.